changing techniques that have become conventional across the United States and Canada in recent years. What I'm supposed to do is give you a list of answers, and you're supposed to vote as to which answer is right. I'm not going to do that, but I just want to prove that I know what the modern thing to do is. In any case, why don't you try to figure out when you think the entropy increases in the in this process of the cue ball hitting the other balls, while I figure out what's going on with my lecture.
Well, there's a lot of things Well, it depends on
Are you supposed to be the expert on this?
Okay, guys. What do you think? When does the entropy increase? Is it now, when the ball is starting out? Is it click when the thing hits? I better put the pockets in. Does it have anything to do with the pockets? No, I guess not. Well, maybe it does. Okay, when does the entropy increase?
After the balls hit the boundary?
Excuse me?
After the balls hit the border of the table?
It depends on whether you're strong enough to... Most of the time it does, doesn't it? So probably that should be taken into account.
If the balls are pocketed?
If the balls are pocketed? Okay, you want to give us an answer.
You try to hit the ball perfectly, but you don't. And I think that's where entropy enters the system.
Okay. We have the problem that the entropy of the entire universe never increases. We have the problem that we have an increase in entropy when we can figure it out for subsystems. But in truth, entropy is mostly defined for equilibrium systems. Equilibrium systems, we have a partition function as e to the s over k minus beta e, where e is the average energy. And that gives us a definition of the entropy for an equilibrium system, and a pretty unambiguous definition of that. However, this is not an equilibrium system, so we can't use that. However, we do have approximations, like the approximation that comes out of the Boltzmann equation, which I suspect you mostly know and will be derived today, integral dp dr of f of p and rt times logarithm f of prt, and that this is minus s over k. So if we have the distribution function for this system, we can calculate the entropy, and we can calculate it for all of these guys. It's a little bit rough, because in fact, this guy is moving with a well-defined momentum, and that means f of p has a delta function in it, which means that the logarithm of f of p is real nasty, being the logarithm of a delta function, and who knows? The answer to your question, which you wisely have not invested in yet, yes?
Yeah, I think that the interval won't change because the number of possible arrangements for all the balls is the same, unless we consider that some balls will be removed.
It depends. Every answer to this question is right. That is, we can't define, this is a good definition of entropy. This is meaningful. It's okay. We have approximate definitions of entropy for non-equilibrium systems. Like that one. That's sort of okay too. That approximate, to some extent, our definitions of entropy depend on where we draw the line around the system. That is, we know that if we draw the line at the end of the universe, we're going to get some sort of funny answer. But if we draw a line here, maybe we can do something. We know that in some sense, we can think about the entropy as changing when we stop being able to reverse the motion. Well, we can catch the ball at this stage and roll it backwards. I guess we can reverse the motion. However, once the thing has gone click and hit the 15 balls, they go off in all directions, and we're not clever enough to be able to reverse the motion. So maybe we should say the entropy increases when those balls start separating from one another. Maybe we should say that the entropy starts increasing when the balls start rolling across the table and by friction heating up the table. That's an increase in entropy. Maybe we should say the entropy starts increasing when the when the system first becomes irreversible. I guess when that happens is when, well, it depends on what your point of view is, but to some extent there are sound waves coming off of this. The thing goes click, makes sound waves. That the sound waves leave what we might think of as our system. Those sound waves can't be caught up again and sent back in. Therefore, we can't reverse the motion. One answer to the question is, as soon as we hear a click, if we're standing outside the system, here we are standing outside the system, if we're standing outside the system and we hear a click, we can be pretty sure that the motion is now irreversible, because you can't send the sound waves back. It's a hard question, but there's an easy question that goes with it. That relatively easy question, well, relatively easy for the tough physics, is what do we get from the Boltzmann equation? And there's some song and dance that I'd like to give you about that as well. Let's see, song and dance requires my notes. There are my notes. Okay. Here's the Boltzmann equation. It's a sort of little world. Things on this side of the Boltzmann equation can happen rapidly or slowly. This, as I told you yesterday, last time, this includes all kinds of things like sound waves and the flow of heat and all kinds of slow stuff. This is collisions. This happens quite rapidly. There's then a distinction between things that might happen slowly on this side and things that certainly happen quite rapidly on this side of the equation. Well, in fact, that's what the world is all about. There's a micro world which does one kind of thing, and that micro world comes up and affects our macro world, which does other kinds of things. And physics is all about the connection between micro and macro. Physics is all about how one of those worlds is connected to another. Physicists also love construct little worlds in their minds. Not only physicists do that. Computer scientists do it. Mathematicians do it. The Boltzmann equation is an example of a little world. You could spend ages understanding what is happening in the Boltzmann equation, understanding how one thing affects another. And it's an interesting thing to do. You can get into that world. Boltzmann certainly did get into that world. He became he had a major investment in this world. In fact, that major investment was a little funny. because in his time, it was somewhat doubtful whether atoms and molecules really existed. The chemists tended to believe in them. Many of the physicists, for example, Mach, tended not to believe in atoms and molecules. They thought they were a fiction. And Boltzmann wrote down this equation involving collisions between things that he couldn't be exactly 100% sure really existed. And then he invested himself in the world in which these things existed. That's a very typical physicist thing to do. I guess I should progress by, in fact, calculating, doing the calculation that has to do with the H theorem here. And to do that calculation, I multiply this equation by the logarithm of F on the left-hand side of the equation, use the differential statement that I told you about last time, that the derivative of logarithm of F divided by the base of exponentials times F is equal to the logarithm of F times the derivative of F, and then use that to analyze this equation. So what I'm going to do is multiply this equation by log F, integrate over P and R, and see what comes out. Everybody happy? Okay. First term, here. That first term, when you fuss with this, comes out to be the time derivative of the integral over P and R of the logarithm of F of PRT divided by the base of exponentials times F. This is then what is called the time derivative of H. Now, I'm not going to analyze these terms in detail. I will just tell you what happens. When you integrate by parts and do the identities that come out from the integration by parts, those terms give you zero. Then all that requires is a statement that at infinite momentum, the distribution function goes down to zero, and that there's some sort of boundary to the system in which nothing passes through the boundary. If you ask me, I'll go through that, but I want to focus on this right-hand side of the equation where there is interesting stuff to be looked at. The integration by parts is pretty dull. So on the right-hand side of the equation, I'm multiplying by log of f of t. And so under the integral sign, I have an integral dp here, because this was integrated over p. I have an integral dr, integral dr is pretty boring because I'm going to analyze the whole thing at fixed r. And then I'm going to look and see what this thing gives me when I analyze it. The first thing I see is that there's a symmetry here between P and Q. They appear in a completely symmetrical form. So I could just as well write, instead of F of P, logarithm of F of Q. That's equally good. I could write one of these or the other, or I could write the sum of them divided by 2. My hands have not disappeared up my non-existent sleeves. You have to look at this and see whether you believe it. If you don't believe it, you have to yell at me. But we're taking this. This is the multiplicative factor under these integral signs, multiplying this stuff. And what we have is we started out with f of p, and then we replaced it by f of p plus f of q divided by 2. No problem. P and Q are symmetrical. When you had F of P, you could equally well have F of Q. You could equally well have the sum of them divided by 2. And that is equally well the logarithm of F of P times F of Q divided by 2. Okay? So that's what we could have on this side of the equation. We could have either this or this, and it's all the same. However, there's a complete anti-symmetry between PQ and P prime Q prime. Except for this change in sign here, the equation has a complete symmetry between PQ and P prime Q prime, and that's because of detailed balance, that R of P Q goes into P prime Q prime is identical to R of P prime Q prime goes into PQ. That being true, I could write F of P prime Q prime here, except I'd have to do it with a minus sign because I have to take into account that minus sign. And if I wanted to do that, why shouldn't I write F of PQ minus F of P prime Q prime logarithm divided by 2, except I now have twice as much stuff as I should have, so I'll divide it by another factor of 2. So this is what I get when I take the Boltzmann equation, multiply by log F and integrate over P, R also, I get the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation, well, it's F of P, F of Q, F of P prime, F of Q prime minus sign, having a multiplicative factor of the logarithm of F of P times F of Q divided by 4 minus the logarithm of F of P prime times F of Q prime divided by 4. Okay? Yes. No.
I don't understand. Why did you divide the by 2?
Because I started out with that. F of P. I said I could replace it. It was just as good as F of Q. I'm doing the first step. That is just as good then, I could replace it by F of P plus F of Q. I start out with a logarithm, the logarithm of F of P plus F of Q divided by 2. Because I could either have this, or the average of the two of them, because it's all gives me the same answer. Okay, let's do it slow.
I was asking about the last one.
Last one, okay. Let's do that slow. We have integrals, blah, 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 blah. We have F of P, F of Q, minus F of P prime, F of Q prime. Then we have the logarithm of F of P, F of Q, divided by 2. This is where we start from. I then change the variables of integration. I have complained to the boss that there is no colored chalk. The lack of colored chalk is a terrible lack in a teaching institution, but let me imagine that I have a piece of yellow chalk in my hands. Here's a piece of yellow chalk, and I'm going to change the variables of integration. dP, dQ, dP prime, dQ prime. And I've been too lazy to write out all of this stuff, but it's symmetrical in P prime, Q prime, symmetrical in everything you want, so it doesn't matter much. So I'm going to change the variables of integration. I'm going to change from P to P bar, Q to Q bar, P prime bar, Q prime, blah, blah, bar, blah, 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 blah. Nothing has changed. And then I will write Q bar equals Q prime, P bar equals P prime, P bar prime equals P, Q bar prime equals Q. And nothing changes here except the minus sign reappears because I've interchanged the two terms. And nothing changes here, except that here I get a P prime and a Q prime. So now what I have is the integral dp, dp, dq, dq, dp prime, dq prime. The same blessed thing, except for a sign change, times the logarithm of f of p prime, f of q prime, divided by 2. In all cases, this is the right-hand side of the equation. I then take the average of this form of the right-hand side and this form of the right-hand side, with the f of p and f of q. The average is then going to be, well, I've written it down already. I've committed myself. The average is the logarithm of f of p times f of q divided by 2 times f of p prime times f of q prime divided by 2, all divided by 2. This 2 was the first averaging over p and q. This q is the second averaging over interchange of p, q and p prime and q prime, which then gave us this minus sign. It's, you have to imagine Boltzmann. Boltzmann is this big bull of a man who doesn't see very well. He has terrible eyesight from birth and is struggling to do this hard calculation. This is easy, relatively easy, the 50,000th time someone's been through it, but this is the very first time. And he goes through reams of paper, struggling with his equation, trying to understand what it means, doing every bit of algebra, doing every kind of substitution you can imagine doing, with the goal in mind of trying to understand how come the entropy increases, how come his equation doesn't have time reversal invariance, how come all those guys have criticized him for writing an equation that doesn't seem to agree with classical mechanics. And this doesn't. Let me go through one more step and you can see why it doesn't or how it doesn't. I don't need the black. One more step. What is the structure here? Well, the structure here is very simple. Let's call x as f of p times f of q. Let's call y f of p prime times f of q prime. The structure that we see here is x times y minus x. It's x minus y. X minus y, that's right here. Multiplied by the logarithm of x minus the logarithm of y divided by 4. And with a minus sign, that's what appears underneath the integral sign on the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation when you go through all of this stuff. You get integrals over basically the sums, so that all of this stuff is a positive thing. This is the scattering probability. It's positive. These delta functions are positive. And then we end up with x minus y times the logarithm of x minus y. So if x is bigger than y, this term is positive and that term is positive, and the whole thing is negative. So the right-hand side is negative. If x is less than y, this term is negative, this term is negative, the right-hand side is negative. If x equals y, it is 0. We got it made. Boltzmann has discovered what he wanted to find out. The equation now reads that the time derivative of the quantity that Boltzmann is calling h is less than or equal to zero. Less than zero if x is different from y any place. Equals zero if x equals y always. It must have been a glorious moment when Boltzmann first recognized this. What happens with when is x equal to y? Well, we've been through this before. It is f of p times f of q is equal to f of p prime times f of q prime. That will happen if f is an exponential of conserved stuff. We've been through it, we know what the answer is. You get e to the minus beta times epsilon p. That's conserved, f of prt. Plus p dot v, or actually the conventional thing to write is minus p dot v, because epsilon p and p are both conserved, and then there's the conventional thing is to write a chemical potential. Or rather, the conventional thing is to write a chemical potential plus 1/2 mv squared. This, with only conserved quantities, epsilon p, p constants up in the exponent, gives us that h, which is then identified as minus s over k, is always decreasing, or entropy is always increasing. You'll recognize this as an approximate argument. The equations that are written down here are not exact equations for anything. They are good approximations for gas. This definition of entropy gives us a definition for a situation in which we are out of equilibrium. And this definition of entropy out of equilibrium is only meaningful within this good approximation. If you calculated the properties of a gas more exactly, you would get a different answer for the entropy, and you would get an answer which probably would be ambiguous as you got to try to do your calculation more and more exactly. The entropy is not tremendously well defined in outside of equilibrium, except within the context of approximations that we make use of in order to understand what's going on. That's why the billiard table is sort of significant. We can make approximations, we can have ideas about what goes on the billiard table, several different ideas. Yes, please.
What does it mean that entropy is not well defined out of equilibrium? For example, if you count the number of microstates for given macrostate, why will it give us bad definition?
Okay, you actually, I have to take you down the path of the Red Queen was taking Alice. down. You believe that the equations of classical mechanics are correct. You believe that the definition of entropy as log rho, average of log rho, it makes some sense. However, the exact calculation means that the entropy for a big system calculated exactly, for an infinite system calculated exactly, does not increase. The number of microstates stays the same.
No, when we're talking about exact calculation, which definition do we use?
Exact calculation. Entropy and an exact calculation, exact as we can do, is quantum mechanically the trace of rho log rho. Or classically, it is the integral over phase space, the sum over product over all alpha. That's 1 over k times s. dp alpha dq alpha times rho log rho. We then calculate this using IH d rho. D rho dt is rho commutator H, or plus on bracket without the H part. In either case, these two things show that ds dt is equal to zero. An embarrassment, since it must be then that the counting of microstates is not a careful and exactly definable procedure. Or maybe something else is going wrong. It is not entirely consistent, the different things we believe. The best way of not getting into trouble is this, that entropy is defined exactly for equilibrium systems, that this is true when rho equals e to the minus beta h, and not otherwise.
There's
another way of thinking about it, which is, gives you, yes, please.
Do you mean rho equals e to minus beta h over z?
Over z, of course. Or rather, the equations are correct, that if you get zero out, you put rho equals e to minus beta h, but if you want to have the probability normalized property, you better put it as z. Another way of thinking about it. We have 10 to the 23rd particles in any respectable system. That means in order to define the entropy, we have to write down something like 10 to the 23rd things. That's an impossible process, not within capabilities of thought. In fact, everything we do with the entropy is roughly at the level of this. We take a simplified point of view, we think a simplified system, we simplify the world, and we then do something which is pretty good. In fact, there are three different things in physics in which you have to worry about this kind of issue. The issue is the difference between the whole world and a subsystem. The d rho dt equals zero implies the whole world. And it is somewhat crazy to try to define anything that has to do with the whole world. So people talk about the probability that the universe has done thus and so. Well, it doesn't make any sense. There is only one universe, and you can't have a probability for it. It has either done that or it hasn't done that. There is no probabilistic description. People talk in quantum theory about separating out the experimentalist and the experiment. That is, if you do an observation in quantum mechanics, you have to describe that observation in such a way that you talk about the effect of the experimentalist on the experiment. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Splitting up the world into an experiment and an experimentalist is a very strange thing to do. And we don't want to have our physics depend upon what we call the experiment and what we call the experimentalist. So in the three examples of entropy, the behavior of the entire universe, and the quantum measurement theory, we have a problem with defining what goes on, because we have a problem with defining what our system is and what is outside the system. This is a deep problem. I'm not going to solve it for you standing here, because we don't know how to solve it. In fact, however, I will go on to other things because I've done as much as I can with this. I should, I guess, spend a little bit of time on telling you a little bit more about the Boltzmann equation. And I will do that if I ever get my blackboard back. I'm going to erase stuff here because I'm going to use this structure for talking about other things. So if anybody wants to talk about what's here anymore, I should stand here and wait for you to ask a question. Equations like the Boltzmann equation are used for lots of things. In fact, the lecture you were in the last hour was talking about scattering theory, and scattering theory is just exactly this kind of thing described in a more quantum mechanical fashion. There are quantum mechanical situations in which one can use an equation like the Boltzmann equation. I better erase the integral of dr and dp, because that had to do with the derivation of the H theorem. And this is the equation we start with. In the 50s and 60s, Landau looked at the properties of what is called the Fermi liquid. Helium-3 is the fermion helium is the primary example of this kind of thing at low temperatures, let's say roughly 1 degree Kelvin, 10 to the minus 3 degrees Kelvin. at these low temperatures, what happens is that particles move, or rather excitations, which are particle-like, move through the system, and they scatter off of one another rather seldom. These excitations are called quasi-particles, and they are close analogs of the particles that field theory and particle physics talk about. They are moving through a mess of liquid, a dense liquid, but they hardly ever scatter off of anything because there are no states available for them to scatter into. If you talk about a fermion system, or talk about any quantum mechanical system, you draw a diagram, a picture, which includes states. And those states have some states that are occupied, usually the states of lower energy, so here's energy, and other states which are empty. And in a system like helium, the states have a very, very close spacing. And there are many, many, many such states. There are only a few states which are not fully occupied. The ones at low energies are fully occupied or fully empty. There are states that are partially occupied, partially empty, and those are the ones that are available for scattering. So by this argument, quasi-particles scatter seldom. In fact, if you make estimates of how many quasi-particles can scatter, or how often the scattering of quasi-particles occur, you get the idea that a quasi-particle with energy at this energy between the unoccupied and the occupied states, the quasi-particles at this so-called Fermi energy, have a scattering rate which is proportional to T squared, T being the temperature. And so, as the temperature goes down, the scattering rate gets very small. And we can then describe the particles as having a well-defined momentum. Just like a photon, an electron, moving through the vacuum, which has a well-defined momentum, called P. And we talk about wave packets of such states, and we give them a position r. And of course, we're looking at all of this as a function of time. And we then describe the system by an f of p r t, a occupation, a probability of finding an occupation for a state of momentum p in the neighborhood of the space point r and the time point t. And then Landau says, let's write down an equation like this in order to describe the behavior of this low temperature helium-3 system. However, he also says, or said, that you have to change the equation a little bit. The equation has to be changed because a particle with momentum p can't scatter into a state with momentum p prime unless that state is empty. The state is required to be empty, and the probability that you will find the state empty, gee, I wish I had colored chalk, but okay, I will write it in, is f of p prime, 1 minus f of p prime, is the probability that you will find the state with momentum p prime empty. And you need another factor of 1 minus f of q prime. in order to have the state with momentum q prime empty, and you need a 1 minus f of p here in order to describe properly the scattering in the other direction, and 1 minus f of q there, and I'll put underlines under my new stuff. There's a poor substitute for colored chalk. It's easy to do. You now write down an equation, and Landau has invented his another little world, a world which is supposed to be describing helium-3. And when experimentalists, particularly John Wheatley, did these experiments at low temperature, they found, in fact, that the Landau description with the scattering rate being proportional to t squared was correct. Lots of other consequences came out, and the consequences all worked out. So, I want to focus on one more consequence for you. The one greatest thing that we got out of the analysis of the Boltzmann equation was a description of what happens in equilibrium.
Sir?
Yeah.
Yes,
please.
I just got you colored chalk.
Excuse me?
I just got you some colored chalk.
Oh, thank you so much, my hero. I will use it for bosons. We do bosons next. Bosons will come out in yellow. Okay. What we had before was a statement that when you satisfy these delta functions, this term cancels against that term because the factors were the same. Now, you can't get the factors exactly the same here, but let me imagine that I divided both sides of this equation by all the factors of 1 minus f. So I divide by 1 minus f of p, 1 minus f of q, 1 minus f of p prime, and 1 minus f q prime. And then I look at the result of that definition. I look and see what's inside these square brackets. Inside the square brackets, I get f of t divided by 1 minus f of p. That is, I'm dividing by the factor 1 minus f of p, and I put it underneath the factor of f. F of p prime, f of q, I'm sorry, divided by 1 minus f of q. I don't get a factor of 1 minus f of p prime, because when I divide 1 minus f of p prime by 1 minus f of p prime, it goes away. Ditto for the 1 minus f of q prime. And the story holds about the same way on the other, after the minus sign, you get an f of p prime over 1 minus f of p prime, and f of q prime over 1 minus f of q prime. You get close parentheses, and you ask, when is it true that you're in equilibrium? You are going to be in equilibrium if this is going to be e to the minus beta, beta being some constant, which we'll eventually identify as the temperature, times epsilon p. If this factor is of the form e to the minus beta epsilon p, and this one is the same form with a q, and this one with a q prime, and with a p prime, and this one with a q prime, then because of these delta functions, because of that delta function, everything will cancel out, and we'll get zero, and we'll be in equilibrium. And then you can add a term p dot v, because of the momentum-conserving delta function. You add a constant, because constants can always be added to this stuff, and conventionally you put in a 1 half mv squared.
Okay.
Conventionally it's a minus sign.
I have a question.
Thank you.
I didn't understand why are you multiplying by those terms, like 1 minus f.
Okay. Let's go back and go talk about that again. I'm a fermion. I live my life the way fermion lives my life. I'm going along and getting, bumping into something. And I want to go, because I bumped into something, I want to go into a new state. I want to have a different momentum. Well, I look around, and I can only go into those states which are unoccupied. I count what states I can go into. This counting was probably originally done by Fermi, but I don't know. And I say the probability that I can land in such a state is the probability that it's empty, and F is the probability that it's full. 1 minus F is the probability that it's empty. I'm assuming, and you catch me as if I'm assuming that in the appropriate space of P and R, the density of states available is 1. And that means that I should have a 2 pi h bar cubed down here to get the appropriate density, but I'm working in units 2 pi h bar cubed. I'm working in units in which h equals 1. So I forgot about that. I've got enough to write down without h bars. Pies. Yes, please.
V dot V and half
okay.
V squared?
The P, the P is easy to understand. What you have is this momentum conserving factor, and every time you have a conservation law, you have another possibility for ways in which you can make this thing zero. In fact, if you have, let me go through it slow again, if you have an epsilon p there, you'll get an epsilon p, epsilon q there, they will add up, and then they can be exactly the same thing as the epsilon p prime and the epsilon plus epsilon q prime that comes from this. And if they're exactly the same thing, the stuff will, the minus sign will give us zero because of this delta function. That's the argument. Same thing happens with the momentum factors. There's a factor of P here, a factor of Q there, up in the exponent. There's a sum of P plus Q then in the exponent. What then happens is that you have a total momentum in the exponent here, a total momentum in the exponent there, and according to this, the total momentum is unchanged. Right, yellow chalk. The total momentum is unchanged. And if the total momentum is unchanged, you can get a cancellation here, and that's what we mean by equilibrium. In fact, you should have known that this was going to happen. Let me show you why. This is e to the minus, in the simplest case, p squared over 2m minus p dot v. Minus plus 1/2 m v squared, which I've been careful to put in, minus mu, which is a nice way of writing e to the minus beta for the simple case, p minus mv squared over 2 m minus mu. You know, I don't have to tell you, but you know it, that if I have a box of helium, box of helium sitting here, and I run past it with velocity v, that helium will be equally in equilibrium whether I'm running past it or I'm sitting still. That's Galilean relativity. That's what the mv is for. You get equilibrium because you have the possibility of having stuff in motion being in equilibrium. And if something else, as I've said before, if something else were conserved, you'd have something else there. this chemical potential is in fact for the particles of a given kind, which is also conserved. We say that a particle plus a particle comes in and produces two particles. That's what the scattering event is about. This then has a solution. F of P, if F over 1 minus F is this exponential, then F of P is e to the plus beta epsilon P plus P dot V minus 1 plus minus P dot V plus 1 half mv squared minus mu plus 1. Let me forget about the V. If I forget about the V, it's e to the beta epsilon P minus mu plus 1. Mu is the thing I called before the Fermi energy. It is known to its friends in thermodynamics as the chemical potential.
Question.
And it goes with this picture. If the energy is above mu, the state is likely to have a low probability of being occupied. Energy above mu means this exponential is large, the f is small. Energy below mu means the exponential is small. This thing is then close to 1. That's what the occupied states down here, empty states up there.
Question.
Yes, please.
Could you take the argument again why we put Fp over 1 minus Fp to the maximum Boltzmann distribution?
Okay. This is... this is pure Boltzmann bullish calculation. We take this structure, and we want to get something which looks nice from it. We want to get something that looks nice, and we don't care about additional positive factors. Positive factors don't bother us at all. So we take this, and we divide by, as it says here, divide by all of the factors 1 minus F that you see there. Whom am I answering? I lost you. There we go. You divide by all of the factors 1 minus F that you see there. There are 4 factors of 1 minus F. 2 of them cancel, and 2 of them go in the denominator. The other 2 cancel gets these, and the other 2 go in the denominator there. That's what the calculation is about. Now, it should be said that you... I've already said it, but let me say it again. None of this stuff is easy. The first time that this was done, probably by Einstein, the first time it was done, it required great insight. Now, Einstein had much more brilliance than Boltzmann. You can see Boltzmann's mind working. Quack, 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 quack. Einstein probably saw it immediately. But either way, it's hard to do this kind of thing. And ordinary human beings like us struggle for hours and hours seeing, getting insight into the algebra like this. Okay. Now, Einstein did this all sort of first. But Einstein's calculation was different. Einstein did both... Oh, no, no, I have a big story to tell. Let me tell my story. I'm sorry. I started out telling you here on this part of the board about scattering. That scattering happened seldom. It was low temperatures. There was only a little bit of scattering. It was proportional to T squared. By the time I got to here, I was able to justify this picture and say, yes, it's true, there's only a little bit of scattering. You got to get the guys to go from states like this to states like that. And there, if the guys are an energy close to there, there are only a few states that you can scatter into. the argument about what happens, Landau's argument, is what is you describe as a self-consistent argument. Tent? Tat? Oh, well. Is there an A or an E there? Somebody can help me.
Self-E.
E, thank you. It's a self-consistent argument. That is, you make it, you then go through a long song and dance, and you come back and you say, oh, my song and dance looks like it agrees with itself. Now, a mathematician would have a fit about this. A mathematician likes to work from axioms and prove things, and if it is self-consistent, it can be self-consistently right or self-consistently wrong. Those are both possibilities. You make the assumptions that starting with T squared, and you end up with this Landau-Fermi picture of what goes on, and that works out. However, not all low-temperature fermion systems are like this. This Landau picture of the Fermi liquid is not the only story at low temperatures. There are other versions of Fermi liquids aren't exactly like this and aren't described in this way. Physicists love self-consistent arguments because they give you results and you can say something about what might be happening. But often, self-consistent means that it's not the only thing that can happen, and there are other low-temperature Fermi liquids subjects of present-day research which people are struggling with. So I told you one kind of Fermi liquid, one kind of low-temperature liquid in a fermion system, but that's not the only possible kind of liquid that you could get out of a fermion system. Apparently, high-temperature superconductors are fermions and different in character, and there are other examples. But now that I've got yellow chalk, I can do bosons. Bosons were studied before this. This was done by Einstein, who thought about photons. Now, as distinct from fermions, which are unfriendly, bosons are very friendly. If there are a lot of bosons already in a quantum state, there tend to be more scattering into that state. Words like constructive interference are used to describe that, but that just means that it's hard to understand. It's hard to understand. But if there are bosons already present in the state, there tends to be more scattering in the into the state. The result of that is that you tend to get more scattering in occupied states. You get, instead of the Fermi factors of 1 minus F, the Bose factors of 1 plus F. This is what how Einstein described photon systems. We know that for photon systems because we know that lasers exist. Lasers are lots of photons existing in the same single particle state. And the lasers form themselves because of lots of scattering into one state. We then progress and do the same calculation again. And equilibrium means that this factor must vanish. And that in turn means that, okay, I will write it out. For bosons, F of p, which is more often written as n of p, the number of particles in the quasi-particle state with momentum p. Thank you, I gotta find another blackboard. Okay, H theorem is long since gone. I'm gonna erase. Anybody wanna complain? No complaints? Erase. Bosons, the number of particles in a state labeled by momentum p is enhanced because there are other particles in that state, and that enhancement is represented by saying that you have a factor of e to the minus beta times energy among, with the state of momentum p minus mu minus 1. Mu, as I already told you, comes from particle conservation. It's a description of the fact that particles are conserved. When there is no particle conservation, that is for photons or phonons.
Question.
Yes, thank you.
Why did you like make this minus plus? Like, wasn't the argument to make this minus plus?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the words.
What was the argument to multiply FPFQ by 1 plus FP prime?
I'm sorry, maybe I didn't understand the question. Yeah, let me go through the logic again. Logic is that you get factors like this from the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah, what's the argument to add this factor here in this equation? And the top left corner.
And when you solve this thing is equal to that,
I see.
With a plus sign, you get a minus sign in here, which then written someplace where everyone can see it is a minus sign here.
Yeah, this is not my question. My question is in the up blackboard, that second line, up blackboard.
In Boltzmann equation.
The Boltzmann equation.
Ah, the Boltzmann equation, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get our Boltzmann equation. We want that back.
Yep.
Let's see if I can do it. Yep, I can do it. Okay. Now.
So for fermions, I understood why we wrote 1 minus FP prime. But what's the
I already told you, I don't understand. That is what those are the particular words I used. That is, it's a result that I know is true. That is a result from the coherence of the scattering of Bose particles. It is a fact. But I have to better understand the coherence of wave functions of bosons in order to actually deeply understand that factor. And I don't deeply understand it. I know what to do, and it's often true, I don't know exactly 110% why I'm doing it. I read the books, I know what to do. I know sort of the argument that goes with coherence and that bosons like to come together, but I can't do better than that. So I'm not doing better than that. I'm just standing here waving my hands around. So there's a plus sign there. And hidden down here is a minus sign. That minus sign has big deal consequences. If I have a particle with, I can't have particles with energy less than mu, because that would give me a negative number of particles, that's nonsense. But if I have particles with energies approaching mu, you can get lots and lots and lots of them all together. And in fact, there is an effect called Bose, or Bose-Einstein condensation. In which, when you get Bose systems at low temperature and reasonably high density, you get a finite fraction of the number, whole total number of particles in the system, all in the same quantum state. So instead of having a picture like this, you have a picture in which this state is filled with zillions of particles, and the next states up are rather empty. That's what happens in low-temperature Bose systems. For photons, there's no mu, and it's e to the beta epsilon p minus 1. Epsilon p for photons is h bar omega p, where omega t is the photon energy and omega is c times k, and k is h bar times p, or p times h, well, there's a factor of h bar there someplace. In any case, that's what happens to photons. I just have a little more story to tell, and I will be done with the Boltzmann equation. So the Boltzmann equation is used in other contexts besides low-density gases. You can use it for high-density fermion gas liquids or Bose liquids or other things of that kind. And then I wanted to tell you, as I started to tell you, what happens when we go to look at situations in which there's slow variation in space and time. I think I could find a clean blackboard here someplace. Go. No, go. Yep. So I'll go back to the classical case. And say that we have the system almost in equilibrium. Almost in equilibrium means that the distribution function f of p, r of t, has the structure e to the minus beta, which is 1 over the Boltzmann constant times the temperature, and the temperature depends on r and t, times p squared over 2m, minus p times the speed of motion of the system, which depends on r of t, plus 1/2 mv of r and t squared, minus the chemical potential, which describes how the density varies in space and time. And then you've got to write down equations for the velocity and the temperature and the chemical potential. And those equations are conservation laws. I started to write down some of the conservation laws. For example, you have that the momentum density, g of r and t, which is equal to the integral dp f of prt times the momentum, that thing is equal to minus the divergence of the stress tensor. And I just want to finish this discussion of the Boltzmann equation by saying what happens to the stress tensor, just so that you have a little bit of knowledge of the subject. The stress tensor, as a function of r and t, has, when you calculate the appropriate integral, t, J, K of R and T is the integral dp, and for the case in which the energy is p squared over 2m, pj, pk over m times f of prt. And you get a diagonal term, as I said last time, which has the pressure in it. This is a different p, this is the pressure, times delta jk. And then you get terms describing the motion, vj times vk of rt. And then you get terms involving the viscosity. A term involving the viscosity has a derivative of v in the jth direction with respect to r in the kth direction, plus derivative of v in the kth direction with respect to r in the jth direction. I tell you that these terms that involve dissipation, like this viscosity term, c- comes because there is a small correction to this local equilibrium stuff. That small correction has to be calculated through the Boltzmann equation. And once you calculate that, you can figure out what the viscosity is. You get a term proportional to that, and you get, can figure out what the viscosity is. So then the Boltzmann equation gives us, just from our analysis of what is going on in the equation, a whole description of the macroscopic world. We have come a long way. We start with the Boltzmann equation, which is a in three-dimensional space, a partial differential equation in seven variables, PRT, nonlinear because of the F squared on the right-hand side, integral because you have integrals on the right-hand side. So it's a seven-dimensional partial differential equation, partial differential integral equation of a nonlinear character. And we can analyze it and understand something about the processes by which momentum and particles are transported in the real world. That's a big deal accomplishment. I will then now spend a few moments going on to other big deal accomplishments. I'm done with the Boltzmann equation, unless we get some questions. I'm going to spend the last four lectures mostly talking about phase transitions. And the work in phase transitions started, the work I want to talk about in phase transitions, started with work in what is called kinetic theory. Kinetic theory is about the calculation of the properties of systems by calculating the detailed atomic motion, assuming that there are atoms around. One of the first calculations of this kind was describes the motion, something called the virial, which was invented by a kinetic theorist by the name of Clausius, working in the middle of the 19th century. He said, wouldn't it be nice if we could analyze the properties of something that he wrote down, the sum over all particles in a gas of the momentum of the particle in the gas dotted into the coordinate written as QJ or RJ, depending on how I feel at a given moment. And he says, let's look at the time derivative of this. That time derivative is stuff that we should regard as very simple and interesting. There are two terms. One is the time derivative of the momentum. The other is the time derivative of the position. The time derivative of the momentum gives us the sum over J times d energy dQJ dotted into QJ with a minus sign. The time derivative of, that's the time derivative of the momentum. That's the derivative of the energy with respect to Q times Q. And the time derivative of the position is equal to, with a plus sign, the sum over all particles times Pj over M. Let me do it more generally. Pj, the derivative of epsilon with respect to Qj. The derivative with respect of momentum is the derivative of epsilon with respect to Q. The derivative of Q is the derivative of epsilon with respect to P. Then Clausius says, let's calculate the integral of this from time t0 up to c over some very, this is over some long period of time. So we're calculating the integral over this some long period of time. Exactly why Clausius wanted to look at this quantity, wanted to calculate this integral, and wanted to calculate this time derivative is not exactly clear to me. However, the result is fairly clear. This, the epsilon dp, is p over m, so we get the sum over j, pj squared over m. Here, if we have a potential u of q, we get minus the sum over j, du of q, dq. So if we have particles in a box, what we have is the time integral of this quantity. If the thing is in equilibrium, then the time derivative is this, the integral of the time derivative is going to give us the result at the beginning minus the result at the end. And that, if the thing is in equilibrium, is going to be equal to zero. And then Clausius said that what we have here is a is essentially the kinetic energy. And when we calculate out what this is, we essentially get the pressure from the walls of the on the walls of the system times the volume. And the this time average says the time average of the kinetic energy is proportional to the pressure times the volume. And so by using this detailed kinetic argument, Clausius got, well, I will not, yeah, well, should I finish it or should I not finish it? Okay, let me go through it step by step. This time integral says that we get something which is average, which is integrated over time. So we get from here twice the kinetic energy, p squared over m, total kinetic energy times the time of the integration. I will next time calculate this quantity and show you that it is proportional to three times the pressure of times the volume of the system times the time interval. We will then get the result that the kinetic energy, the pressure times the volume is proportional to the kinetic energy. The kinetic energy is something that Clausius knew, or rather invented. He invented temperature as being proportional to the kinetic energy. So we ended up saying PV is K is proportional to KT. This is what we will get out next time. We will also get a slightly different argument, which will give us the corrections to PV is NKT. Okay. Corrections to, I'll start out by deriving pressure times volume is NKT, according to Clausius. I will then get corrections to get to van der Waals, and then use van der Waals in order to talk about the phase transition of fluids. The talking about the phase transition of fluids will then take me into a discussion of mean field theory. I will then talk